Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how senior business leaders face change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, I'm Janelle McMaster, and welcome to the Change Happens podcast, a conversation with influential leaders on leading through change and the lessons they've learned along the way. And today I'm joined by Michelle Price, CEO of Ost Cyber. Michelle is a passionate advocate for all things cyber, but that's going to become apparent to you pretty quickly when you listen to her speak. Michelle was the inaugural Chief Operating Officer of Ost Cyber when she joined the company in January 2017 and then was quickly appointed as CEO in April 2018. And prior to that, Michelle was with the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, where she played an instrumental role in the delivery of the highly regarded 2016 Australia's Cybersecurity Strategy and Coordinated National Security Budget. Michelle was recently awarded the AWSN Award of 2020 by the Australian Women in Security Network, and that recognises and honours the accomplishments and contributions of individuals or companies that are making a real difference in reshaping the security landscape. Michelle has made significant strides in the world of cyber, and her ability to lead change across the cybersecurity ecosystem has resulted in new growth avenues for Australia's economy, both domestically and abroad. I look forward to exploring how Michelle goes about creating change and hearing the lessons that she's learned along the way. Welcome, Michelle. How are you?
I'm great. It's so good to be with you, Janelle. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm excited to have this conversation. Before we get into it, Michelle, in layman's terms, what does Ost Cyber do and what does your role entail?
Ost Cyber is one of the federal government's six industry growth centres. And so we focus on the growth of cybersecurity. And my job is to grow Australia's cybersecurity industry and ensure that we're globally competitive and we can contribute to the country's sovereign capability when it comes to cybersecurity. But I guess a bit more than that too is to make sure that the broader economy understands the role of cybersecurity as a growth opportunity as well.
Just sort of thinking about the context that we find ourselves with COVID, I imagine, you know, with a near overnight shift to remote working, digital businesses completely rethinking their supply chains, there's quite a massive set of implications for Ost Cyber. How has COVID been impacting your professional world?
It's been so significant. I think that, you know, obviously there's been a lot of discussion in the national media about the increase of malicious cyber attacks on Australia during the lockdown periods, plural now, but also more broadly, the sort of vulnerabilities that have emerged within the Australian economy that can be taken advantage of through malicious cyber activity. And I think further than that, there's been that realisation now that goes beyond our own sector into broader economy that we are living now in a cyber-physical world, that things that have a physical manifestation will also have a digital manifestation, and things that go on within the digital world can have physical impacts as well. And so from the moment that we found out from the World Health Organisation, you know, all the way back in February that there was a global pandemic emerging, Ost Cyber got super busy, and we could foreshadow some of the things that were coming, but of course, like everybody else, there was lots that we didn't foreshadow or foresee at all. And so it's been a mix of going into full tilt support to those companies within our portfolio and our industry more broadly to help them survive. But of course, with the increased demand on cybersecurity services and products to help remote working and remote schooling, it's also been about sort of right-sizing some of that capability to be able to be deployed quickly, but also to help the smaller companies within the industry understand where they can fit because they haven't necessarily had the scale to be able to deploy quickly. But that's scaled right up into, you know, being able to help the Australian government as well as governments overseas try and work through the sort of quagmire of problems and challenges that the world has been facing during this time.
Just speaking about Australian government and malicious activity, in June this year, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced that Australian private sector and the public sector organisations had been under sustained cyber attacks by a foreign government. And over the past, you know, 6 months, we've seen a lot of headlines mentioning Australian organisations that have been attacked. In your opinion, how well placed are we as a nation to individually and collectively deal with that increasing threat?
I think that from an individual point of view, the situation is vastly different from where we were 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's still not at a level where we can say that we've got overall baseline and common understanding across the Australian community about why it is so important to be thinking about the security and privacy ramifications of the types of activities we do in this cyber-physical world. But collectively, I think we've really stepped up our game over the past 4 years in particular, since the release of the 2016 National Cybersecurity Strategy. And the government obviously has released an update to that this year with the 2020 Cybersecurity Strategy. And I think in between, there's been almost every jurisdiction in Australia has also released its own cybersecurity strategy to organise at the state and territory level as well as local government level. And that's really driven forward a lot of change within the ICT and technology areas of the economy. We're probably still, though, honestly, quite lumpy when it comes to broadening out across the rest of the sectors that haven't traditionally had digital infrastructure as their first port of call. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this obviously manifest in challenges and problems in moving rapidly from an office environment or a school environment into the home environment. And we've seen a lot of vulnerability be exposed as a result of that. So We're doing better than where we were sort of, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, but we still do have a way to go. But I guess the upside within that is that we shouldn't feel as though that's a depressing state. This is actually the situation for every nation on the planet. And the high bar that is set around what great looks like when it comes to cyber resilience is often Estonia, because Estonia does have a very centralised approach to digital identity and the intersection of physical infrastructure and digital infrastructure. But we need to remember that Estonia actually did that in response to some significant attacks from their near neighbour, Russia, and had a really, really big push on trying to maintain their sovereignty through the digital domain and how that then impacted on the physical domain. Australia is in a very, very different position, and we often refer to the incentives to step up our cyber security game coming from the economy more so than the protection of, you know, our country's sovereignty. So the incentives to do this is very, very different. But we're certainly not at the bottom of the pack by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, we're one of the top nations within our part of the world when it comes to dealing with cyber risk and cyber threats. And more broadly across the world, we probably sit somewhere in the top half. So we're not doing too badly.
And I understand this is a big week for you with Cyber Week. Can you tell us what that's all about and why it's so important during this time of recovery?
Yeah, Cyber Week, we're doing this for the fourth year in a row at AusCyber, and it's all about having a national focus for a week where we can, I guess, de-risk, disarm, myth bust all of the things that go into people's perceptions of what cybersecurity actually is, and really open up conversations around different elements of the cybersecurity industry and the role that it has on both the Australian economy but also the community more broadly. And so this week we've got a huge amount of activity going on across the country, both in hybrid events through an online platform that's a bit like a circuit board style a virtual conference where people can access a whole range of different topics to learn more about what goes on for cybersecurity, but also to meet the companies that are these fantastically innovative entrepreneurs that are both inventing but also driving change through both products and services in the economy globally. It's all free. Engage, engage, engage.
So just picking up on the point around the quality of skills that we have available to us in this market, and clearly skills can be used on the wrong and the right side of the ledger. I'm interested in hackathons that are being run. I guess they're ethical hackers who get applied to solve problems like Missing Persons Week, for instance. Can you tell us a bit about that?
At AusCyber, we work quite closely with the National Missing Persons Coordination Unit, which is a part of the Australian Federal Police, to be able to take some of the live cases, the real cases out of National Missing Persons Week, and apply that within a hackathon type environment where we use ethical hackers within teams of four people come together to actually use what's called open source intelligence to be able to see whether or not we can generate new leads for police to follow through on in finding those real missing people. We worked on 14 real cases last year, and while we haven't been able to solve any of those cases through the hackathon, almost all but one of those cases actually had the generation of new leads that police are still working through. This year, again, we'll be working on different real missing people cases. And what we also do as part of that, and I'm getting tingles as I say it, we actually get the families of the missing people involved in the hackathon. And I cannot describe the amount of energy that is in the room for this hackathon, where we have the caseworkers from the missing persons unit, police officers who are investigating the cases, the family of those who have left behind, these teams of ethical hackers that come together of all different skills and maturity, ages. It's a really great showcase of skill being applied to a complex problem. But of course, we can't escape the emotional side of it, of being able to use our community of ethical hackers to be able to find real missing people. It's incredible. It's a privilege. It is incredible.
And it was such a powerful application of the skills being used on the right side of the equation. It's hard not to be aware of the enthusiasm in your voice when you speak about this stuff. And actually, when you and I spoke last week, you said something to me that sort of stuck in my mind. You said that people accuse you of being passionate about cyber, which I thought was an interesting turn of phrase. Obviously, the word accuse has a negative connotation to it. Why did you use that word as a kid? Do you think people see it as a negative thing? And what is it about cyber that has you so passionate about it?
Oh, such a good question. I think that the accused piece is because, you know, the sort of the birth of cybersecurity came out of national security and this concept of the way that you protect a nation and the crown jewels around that being sort of vested in a nation's government. And that's all for very good reason. Within that space, though, of course, the behaviours of how you go about doing the business of traditional cybersecurity has been very conservative and bound up in the world of the intelligence community, which is a world that I have spent some time in. And so fully appreciate why it is the case for that part of the industry and sector. But there's this whole world out there that exists beyond that, that needs to actually exist to support the intelligence and national security communities and vice versa. And so when you come out of a very, conservative and comparatively narrowly focused world as a discipline, and you kind of have this birthing out into the broader economy and broader society, having a passion for the topic and understanding how it can have positive impact and help grow the size of the pie for both individuals, their families, as well as the economy and sustain the prosperity that Australia enjoys so much. You know, I think that you stand out from all of that conservative world. And so I've come out of many years of being accused of being passionate and that, you know, as part of, I guess, the culture that we're hopefully sort of starting to cast aside now into history in Australia, that we have traditionally, of course, assigned passion to tall poppy syndrome. Mm. And that, you know, that sort of that element of Australian business, whether that business be in the public or private sectors, has been something that's obviously been quite a legacy that has in many respects held us back as a nation. And so, you know, to see all of that negative connotation starting to be sort of, I guess, unshackled and, you know, sort of not being valued anymore as a part of how we do business, as much as there is a long tail to that, I think is a really, really positive thing. And so I now kind of actively joke, as I did with you, Janelle, that, you know, I get accused of being passionate and I talk about that publicly reasonably often because it's about inspiring people of all ages, all ethnicities, all genders to be able to feel as though they are empowered to jump in and understand cybersecurity because it is just so important to everyone's lives now.
And is there any one moment or moments maybe that you can remember that really ignited your resolve and your passion to get into this space?
Yeah, I think the moment for me came when I was working in the Prime Minister's department and it was under Prime Minister Gillard. And at the time I was working on the National Security Strategic Risk Framework, which was the first of its kind, actually it turned out, in the world. And one of, in doing the risk assessment as part of the development of that framework to kind of demonstrate to the senior people within government, including ministers, why we needed to embark on such an endeavour. You do your horizon scan, and of course you translate the threats that emerge in that horizon scanning, as well as the opportunities to translate that into risk, both upside and downside. I came across this thing of called cybersecurity, and I'd heard a little bit about it through various conversations and reading various material as I had to in that role in national security within the Prime Minister's department. Became instantly fascinated around its, I guess, sense of convergence, that it really embodied such a range of different disciplines and thinking and creativity, as well as needing to have structure and robustness and trust. And for me, that just brought together in an instant all of the different things that I had worked on within my career to date. And I also saw in that moment that it was going to become one of the biggest issues of our generation.
What was it like working with the first and only female Prime Minister?
It was, can I say, and I hope that, wouldn't it be amazing if Julia was listening?
Well, she was have a wider audience, so, you know, it's not outside the realms of the possible.
Well, if you're listening, Julia, it was amazing to work for you.
So tell me about the changes then, that if you were to sort of to bullet point a few changes that you would be seeking to lead or drive at AusCyber, what are those changes?
I think first and foremost, for me, it is about recognising in the country that we really do have talent in Australia around cybersecurity, both in product and service. That from my background, you know, as a kid, I grew up in a house of inventors. Both my mum and dad invented foods. You know, I love telling people this, but, you know, my dad invented the pine lime splice and the golden gate.
No way. Do you really?
Yes.
It's just a gem. I love pine
lines. It's super cool. And my mum and dad were both food technologists. You know, when they went to university, which is where they met, they were doing food technology, and food tech has now become a new thing again. They were doing this in the 70s. And their food technology strengths focused on sort of, you know, food innovation. And so they invented things, and, you know, mum invented the technology that enabled caramel within the Magnum Ego to remain liquid when the ice cream is frozen. And that's now used in space. That's the environment that I grew up in. And so, you know, being able to kind of appreciate the value of entrepreneurship and the value of small business and the value of small business scaling into medium-sized business and seeing firsthand the impact that that has on both community and economy, and that that really has been the lived experience of a lot of Australian business. For me, I want to see that happen for cybersecurity, because cybersecurity has such an important role now, as I've mentioned. And so that's one of the changes that I'm trying to drive at AusCyber, is that understanding of how we really can do this, not just for ourselves, but to be able to impart some of that capability into the right hands globally to help others as well. And I think the second thing for me is around how we can use cybersecurity, how it can be a use case for technological change, where we do see the convergence of technology and humans happening every day. And further, how we adapt as humans in that point of convergence and really drive forward the changes we want to see around diversity in our community. There's lots of misperceptions and misunderstandings around what it genuinely is when you sort of have these images from the movies and the TV shows and all of that kind of stuff around how complex it is. Absolutely, it's complex, but that's why we need everyone involved. Then, of course, you know, we want to make sure that people further value the fact that it is okay to make money from being an entrepreneur, and that in Australia, entrepreneurship often means that when you make that money, you're giving back as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a spirit that I think that we can carry forward for future generations, to continue that spirit of giving in Australia. At times, maybe we've stepped back from that a little bit. If there's a couple of good things that could come out of the cascade of events over the past 12 months in Australia with, you know, drought, flood, fire, mm-hmm. and pandemic, it's that we can come together in times of crisis, but it shouldn't take a crisis for us to maintain that spirit.
AusCyber put out a digital trust report, and in that report you talk about the role that digital trust plays in attracting investment, in driving job growth, in enabling growth opportunities across other sectors of the economy. How do we Australia, rate on the dimension of digital trust, and what do we need to do to lift our digital trustworthiness?
Oh, that's so good. There's so much to unpack in that. I think that, you know, it's interesting, again, this tall poppy thing comes into play because domestically I think that we're actually quite distrusting of each other, even though we're reasonably good at going after solving complex problems. There's so many sort of, you know, sort of tensions that exist across the way that we do business and how we collaborate with each other in Australia. Outside of Australia, particularly within this region of the world, we are actually seen as a trusted and sometimes in the world of technology, honest broker in being able to navigate the complexity of what we find ourselves in. And so beyond our shores, I guess as per usual, the learned experience of the past 30 or 40 years, Australia actually fares quite well when it comes to the sort of digital trust quotient, if you like. We are often drawn in across, it doesn't matter really if it's government, business or academia, we are drawn into international conversations because we are seen as being knowledgeable. That knowledge is trusted, and we are seen as being a trusted set of hands in how you go about applying that knowledge. Domestically, though, of course, we love a fight. We love the battle. You know, we see that on the sporting field. It translates into how we do business domestically. It's fascinating. And we do need to, I think, particularly when it comes to these concepts of a cyber-physical world and, you know, the digital infrastructures that we're investing a huge amount of time and effort into now and, of course, the data that those digital infrastructures carry, we need to, I think, increasingly remember, it's almost like we've got to have it on the post-it note on the computer screen kind of thing to remind ourselves that we are actually all on the light side of the equation.
And so others see us overseas, they view us as more digitally trustworthy than we view ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
Indeed. That's absolutely the case. Now, of course, we know that trust is hard to earn and very easy to lose.
Correct.
Some of the changes that we've made in Australia at a regulatory and legislative standpoint has eroded some trust over the past couple of years in Australia, but it's been very limited to particular industries. And this is, again, where we see that kind of conversation happening around, you know, sort of the flow through of culture where Europeans are kind of seen as being a bit more open and sort of less risk averse as opposed to the Americans and by association, I guess, the so-called Five Eyes nations of which Australia is a part. And that we tend to be more conservative when it comes to matters of national security and the way that national security intersects with community. And, of course, the big issue that's happened over the past two generations in that case is terrorism. And, of course, New Zealand had to be the latest example of how that gets borne out through changes in legislation last year. And necessarily so, of course, in trying to push back against that kind of intrusion on Australian and New Zealand and global lifestyle. The trustworthiness piece is just it's a classic case of that convergence between human and technology. Because, of course, now we are entering into conversations around whether or not we can trust the technology, whether or not we can trust the machines. And in a world of artificial intelligence, can we trust the data that the machines are talking to us about? And that relationship between machine and human. But, of course, we need to remember in all of that that it's the humans that are developing the machines.
That's right.
And so we can get into lots of conversations about ethics, but ultimately, at the very basis of that, it is about trust.
It's interesting, you know, you talked a lot about the complexity, which I completely agree with you on, but you talked about this physical threats and infrastructure. In a megatrends report that we wrote at EY fairly recently, actually, we mentioned that cyber warfare has expanded into a new domain altogether, and that's around disinformation. So the target's not just physical infrastructure, it's not about data or money, but it's actually around truth and truth itself. And we saw that really come into public consciousness in the 2016 US presidential election, for instance. So there's every reason to think that tactics can be used to attack, that like the disinformation tactics can be used to attack companies. I know that the Edelman Trust Barometer, for instance, found that 6 in 10 people across 27 countries are no longer sure what's true and what's not. And in 2019, the coverage of fake news and conspiracy theories increased by 93%. So I guess my question, Michelle, to you on this one is, what's your thoughts on the weaponizing of disinformation as a threat to companies, and what responsibilities do business and government leaders have to counter that kind of threat?
Yeah, this is a really interesting area, and it's one that is climbing up risk registers all over the place, but perhaps not as much in Australia as what it needs to be. And I think the conversations around foreign interference is probably what's going to start to scratch the surface around this one for Australia, because absolutely companies do need to be more aware around what risks this can have for their operations. And, of course, if a company is listed, what kinds of implications this can have for shareholders. And, you know, we've long had discussions publicly through, particularly through the media, but also through other forms of communication around the ways that these kinds of acts of disinformation can have an impact on, you know, hostile stakeholders and shareholders, hostile board directors, and whether or not, you know, the hostility is actually true. It is really, really complex. And, of course, this is where it gets really properly scary for a lot of business owners as to how they could keep across that kind of a landscape.
Exactly.
Especially with the pace of how everything is happening these days. When you do pick up your phone to be able to quickly do an internet search around answering a question really quickly to be able to just move on with your day. And that can obviously expand out into quite serious and significant decisions that companies and organisations might be making about their future and the way that they spend money or the way that they hire staff, the way that they manage their staff, all of those kinds of things. And I mean, ultimately, of course, the responsibility does lie with organisations when it comes to the business world, whether that be government or the private sectors. But I do think this is where, you know, it's one of the manifestations in our modern world, if we can keep referring to it as that. It's the current world and what we're seeing over the horizon as there needing to be business and government in lockstep. Mm-hmm. We have to work on this together because there will necessarily be organisations within the economy, whether they're small agencies, and if you think I apply this to local government is now very distanced in their service delivery from the federal government, for example. Mm-hmm. How did they keep pace with these kinds of things in the same way as how does the local sole owner franchise of a lawn mowing business stay across this when they absolutely could be leveraged as a vector for disinformation through either their website or their invoicing or even their Facebook presence in the same way that a very large corporation could be. And I say to my team all the time, if we're not five steps ahead of the rest of the industry, ensuring that the stepping stones are there behind us, then actually we're not doing our job effectively. Mm-hmm. It's our job to take the bullets out in front of making some of the mistakes early so that the rest of industry can benefit.
How do you do that? How do you stay ahead of the threats?
Great question. It's really, really hard. But the first thing to do is to actually care, understanding what the threat landscape looks like. If you're an individual and family and school and community group, you can go to staysmartonline.gov.au. And if you're a business or you're even a government agency, you can go to cyber.gov.au. These are resources that provide alerts around the kinds of threats that are manifesting at the moment. The first thing is understanding, and reading the news is a really good way to stay across some of the threats that manifest. If you go to reputable sources, there's lots of websites that are being actively protected against disinformation and fake news. That means that you can trust those as information sources to be able to better inform yourself, to ask the right questions.
It strikes me that there's a number of words that people use in the cyber world that they have a really specific meaning in the world of digital and cyber. You know, words like trust, resilience, vulnerability. But those words also carry a hell of a lot of weight in the world of when I talk of leadership styles and attributes. And I just wonder if that's something that you're conscious about, that you're thinking about, that these words of vulnerability, resilience, testing, failure, trust, how do you marry that up when you're talking about it in cyber and how you lead personally?
Yeah, I marry it up all the time in my own mind. Whether or not I'm effective at demonstrating that or talking about it, I guess that's for others to decide. But, you know, I guess one of the principles of how we do business at AusCyber is modelling the behaviours that we would love to see collectively. And I don't mean it's AusCyber telling the rest of industry how to behave. I guess, you know, I've been told by numerous people over the past, particularly 12 months, that my leadership style is more from the centre. Mm-hmm. And really, of course, that's actually how cybersecurity needs to behave as an industry. We need to be leading from the centre and showing a better way on how cybersecurity enables all other industries, but also within our own industry, how different capabilities enable others. and how you can have that collaboration and cooperation happening within the sector as well. And so being, you know, vulnerable within cybersecurity is something that is very, very treacherous because, of course, the second that you admit vulnerability means that you are open to attack. And if we're open to attack, it means that actually we're exposing our clients, customers, colleagues, partners, upstream, downstream to attack. And so thinking about it from that perspective is that, you know, it's less of a focus on vulnerability as a leader and more about empathy. Because we do need to lead with empathy because, you know, being attacked through cyber means is one of the most devastating things that anyone can go through now because it does have physical ramifications. And, you know, one of the examples that I give often to kind of illuminate, it's a pretty negative one. So I sort of, you know, give the warning that, you know, this can unsettle some people. But, you know, if at the cost of less than $50, a perpetrator of domestic violence really can end a woman's life and do that in front of her children by buying information on the darknet. Around their whereabouts. And so, you know, sort of that sort of sense of having a new identity and that identity being protected by agencies and things like that is really challenging business these days because of the pace at which information can be obtained and then sold at a really cheap rate. And that rate has come down from hundreds of dollars only a couple of years ago. And so to kind of really, that just really sharpens
brings it to
the brain.
Life, doesn't it? Yeah.
It really does.
Michelle, just turning to your pretty amazing career trajectory, you've had a collection of skills and experiences and evidently so have your parents, which I find fascinating. You started out studying graphic design, then you moved into food safety, so no doubt that was inspired by your parents. And then you became a cyber specialist and that included 5 years with the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Can you give me a bit of a potted history maybe of how each of those transitions happened and perhaps what it was from each role that you carried forward and evolved into the next role?
Yeah, sure. I think so I also studied economics at university. So I did economics and business law first and then I did graphic design. And I think that
when natural progression.
That's right. When I get forced to admit in that very un-Australian way what the strengths are that are at the foundation of my career, it's that I did listen to my left and right brains. Was one of the first six students to graduate in the country with environmental economics. Didn't actually kind of end up getting a job in that space because it was so new that I instantly then thought in my final year, well, I kind of really like colour and the psychology of colour and then went off and did graphic design straight off the back of graduating from my economics degree. But I did my graphic design degree while working full-time in food safety risk and that was actually in my parents' business. So they owned three companies, one of which was a global company. Ended up running one of those companies for them largely and I guess it was kind of a convergence of the two degrees in one job. That's sort of, I guess, what gave me a pretty strong sense of what small business is in Australia. And at the time, Mum and Dad were actually writing on behalf of the federal government the national food safety standards for the country for the first time ever, which then got adopted and adapted into sort of, you know, different jurisdictions in the country. And they went on to help out Woolworths, Coles, New South Wales government, Victorian government to actually figure out what food safety meant. And so, again, that spirit of community and that spirit of business and being able to marry those two was instilled in me very, very early. Of course, the backdrop of invention and going after your entrepreneurial spirit and all of that kind of stuff. But I ended up marrying a boy in uniform of the Air Force variety. And so I ended up in Canberra. And it was interesting because, you know, we got posted here and I'd always had an interest in politics. And so, you know, coming to Canberra and sort of, you know, seeing what government had to offer, I just jumped in and it was a completely different world. But for whatever reason, early days, that sort of bringing into my first job in government, which was in workplace health and safety at Comcare, having a leader in that agency at the time who recognised instantly that there was someone in me that not only understood economics and as it applied to different sort of contexts, but also understood risk. And that this was at the juncture of when, you know, Comcare on behalf of government policy was trying to nationalise workplace health and safety legislation and get away, sort of remove this kind of separation of different ways of doing workplace health and safety legislation around the country. really interesting time to jump in and start to understand how legislation is developed and drafted, how you form trusted relationships between government and industry. And those were some really hectic conversations around how we needed to do better on as a country on that with people. Those skills come through from my private sector experience into that world. Actually, it was what propelled me forward. I didn't stay at Comcare for very long because then I got sort of poached from there to go off to customs, got poached from customs to go off to Medicare, got poached back to customs again, and then got poached off to the Prime Minister's department. And so I guess the sort of thread across all of that was this understanding of how industry worked. And how, you know, sort of relationships really, really mattered. Mm. Putting the shoes on of the other people sitting across the table from you in negotiations, but also, of course, having a pretty in-depth understanding of the difference between threat and risk, but necessarily how they operate together. The time at PM&C was just, it was critical in where I'm up to as a person. It was a privilege to work for four people that were five prime ministers. Prime Minister Rudd had two shots at it, everyone would remember. absolutely, I do have my favourites in those four people, but, you know, it is a privilege when you work in that environment, and when you're working on national security, it can get very, very sharp. You are dealing with life and death situations, and I learned a huge amount. And across the trajectory, I was always that square peg because I'd come out of industry. At one time, I was the only person on the national security side of the equation that had worked in industry, but it was highly valued by the very senior people, including prime ministers.
Well, most people, when they describe themselves as square pegs or sort of sitting outside of the norm, see that as something that is problematic. When did you realise that that actually was your strength, that you were sort of different to everybody else in terms of your skills, experiences, profile?
I think it was probably when I was doing the work on the National Security Strategic Risk Framework, where I had the trust of the then National Security Advisor, Duncan Lewis. Mm-hmm. We don't have a National Security Advisor at the moment as a position within government, but at the time I was working to Duncan, and he trusted me to be going and having conversations with some very, very senior people in government. And I was a middle-ranked person at the time, and he knew that I had the subject matter expertise. He also trusted that I had the right kind of experience and self-awareness to understand how to read the body language and the circumstances of the people sitting across the table from me. And, you know, I guess after having a series of kind of quite, you know, heart in throat conversations, because they got quite pointed with some of these very senior people, you know, that I actually did have something to offer because of how different I was, and that I needed to just slightly reframe how I positioned that to be seen by them, not just by Duncan, as an asset, and an asset in how they could pursue, you know, what they were trying to get done in the whole equation as well. And that was probably where it came from, I think.
What changes do you think need to be made in order to encourage more women to become more involved in the industry and to nurture greater diversity in cyber?
It would not be surprising to you, Janelle, that I get asked this reasonably often.
Yes.
It's a challenging question because, you know, I deeply appreciate that for a lot of women but also, you know, people from ethnically diverse backgrounds and First Australians and First Nations people, as well as those who are gender diverse, it can be incredibly challenging. Mm. And I guess what I would say in the first instance is that I'm really proud that now in cybersecurity, increasingly I'm not a minority, but I'm very, very conscious of the kinds of emotions and kinds of challenges that I experienced when I was part of the minority. And I guess, you know, for groups that are still experiencing barriers to entry and barriers to being valued, that there's still a long way to go in that equation. And I guess, you know, the number one piece of advice that I give to people of any age, any persuasion, is to figure out who you can trust, even if that's someone within your own family. Figure out who you can trust and ask for help. Because the experiences that you are experiencing in having barriers or challenges in being valued and being appreciated, you're not alone. you're absolutely not alone. And I say to particularly younger girls and women who are just entering into technology fields, including cybersecurity, but also people of ethnically diverse backgrounds, because, of course, in anything that has anything to do with national security, there are matters of having security clearances, which can make it challenging. You know, asking for that trusted help means that you can leverage people like me who have gone through these kinds of challenges and experiences before, and you'll get some really, really helpful advice. But use us as your bulletproof vest for as long as you need it. Use us to help you push forward in those barriers, because there is absolutely no shame in doing that. There just isn't. And if there are people around you that are making you feel shameful for asking for that kind of help, they're not useful to you in your career endeavours and what you want to have impact on in the world. That's probably the sort of the sharpest point that I can say, because it is really hard. Of course, this is all driven by emotion, and it's really hard to cast aside those emotions that get reinforced, especially the negative ones. And so, you know, I guess I'm acknowledging that this stuff is really tough and it's really, really hard, and that the Australian way, but also the Western way, is that if you ask for help, you're admitting that you're not perfect, and that we need to be perfect to be considered and to be considered valuable and to be worth it. And that's just simply not true. And again, I'm trying to use our industry in cybersecurity as the use case for change around these things, to be able to stand up and call out some of these really quite treacherous but also quite tricky behaviours that can happen. And, you know, we absolutely, coming to the economic side of it, we have to have diversity. We all know, we can see now through the work of many organisations, the economic metrics around why we need to have diverse boards, why we need to have diverse management, why we need to have diverse teams in making decisions and getting work done. As a country, we have to do that to be able to continue to even just maintain our global competitiveness, not just grow it. And so it is now an economic imperative, quite apart from the fact that culturally and from a community standpoint, largely as a society, we want that to happen as well.
Couldn't agree with you more, Michelle. So if I sort of draw the formal questions to a close with maybe a broad big one, and maybe you can look into your crystal ball as you as you answer it, but from your perspective, what does recovery and reframing the future look like to you? If you think about our country, what do we need to do to really maybe take advantage of the respective crises that we've navigated together as a country? What do we need to do to recover and reframe?
It is a big question. I think that
I'll give you some light ones after this, I promise.
I think that, you know, I can never give one answer. I think I'm going to give a couple of answers. The first one is that we need to move deliberately away from having a hierarchical structure to our economy to having one that is networked. We already see a whole range of technology-oriented segments of sectors there. They are taking a networked approach to how they structure their businesses, how they engage with internally within their organisations, how they engage with their partners, suppliers, customers, etc. We need to do that. We have to, or we are going to get left behind. And what better time to be doing that now than ripping the Band-Aid off on some of that legacy? But, you know, structurally we are still hierarchical as an economy, and it means that, to me, that's one of the number one barriers around diversifying the base of our economy. I think the second point is that we have to back ourselves and recognise that we really do have global strengths. It's not in some of the areas that we have nostalgia attached to. But that doesn't mean that we can't leverage the knowledge that has come out of those industries that are seeing sunset happen for them. We have to leverage that knowledge. We need that knowledge. And I think we'll find that for most of the people involved in those industries that, you know, are now sort of, you know, a lot of those people are retired but are on the verge of retirement, you know, they want to be able to help. They absolutely do. Everyone I speak to in those age brackets want to give back. They want to still be involved. They want to keep their minds active because, of course, we all know that the science of dementia and Alzheimer's is that we need to keep our minds active. But also for those industries that are transitioning, that, you know, there's lots that can be leveraged there that doesn't require significant structural reform to be able to get done. And I think the third point is that we need to just celebrate more. You know, Australia
I'm up
has,
for that.
Absolutely. Australia has got so much going for it. And we shouldn't be afraid to, you know, celebrate the wins. That, you know, let's absolutely recognise that poppies were never Indigenous to Australia. We have so many other things that flourish in our landscape that we can reference and celebrate just the growth and the trajectory that we have in front of us if we can get a couple of these foundational pieces right.
Oh, how about that? That was a great answer to a big question, big vague question.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
Okay, so I'm going to finish with three fast, much lighter questions, Michelle. So firstly, what's a misconception that most people have about you?
I've only ever worked in government.
Well, we know that, not to be too. I'm trying to figure out where you haven't worked, to be quite honest with you. What's one guilty pleasure? We like to keep it PG, if possible.
PG, guilty pleasure. I love binge watching things that completely take me away from what I spend most of my time doing. So, you know, sort of the kinds of...
So border security wouldn't be one of those.
I used to be involved in it, so no, but my kids love it. Bondi Rescue or, you know, Housewives of New York. Or
very good. I should compare notes with you. And what's one thing that you're hopeless... This is going to be a tough one for you. What's one thing that you're hopeless at?
I am absolutely hopeless at getting out of bed before 8 o'clock on a Sunday and then get cranky with myself because I haven't fit everything into my day that I want to fit in. I'm absolutely hopeless at it, which means that it kind of does bleed into the rest of the week. Sometimes I struggle.
You need to be kinder to yourself if that's the bit. Take the sleep in, celebrate the sleep in. There you go.
That's good. I like that. Thank you.
Michelle, I thank you so much for your time today. So much to be taken from this conversation, not least of which is the passion for your industry. And I think that you've really painted a compelling picture about why we should all care about the industry and about what it means for our nation. A few things that really stood out to me is, you know, a bit of a theme, whether it's through your own history and the way that you've worked, but as you called it, the networked economy. But for me, what I also saw in the way that you've worked is the power of understanding the intersectionality of industries, of skills, of relationships, and then the collaboration and the co-creation and cooperation that's required to work in that space. So I think that's been really powerful. I think your point about backing ourselves, our capabilities, our digital trustworthiness, if the rest of the globe sees it, then we should too. And I think that we need to back that capability and make sure that we leverage that and really achieve what we can from that. And I really liked your point about, you know, following intuition. If something doesn't feel right, there is no harm in asking a question, and there's no harm, and probably there's a real imperative to follow the trail of that question to understand how that could be physically manifested in organisations. So some powerful takeaways, and I know there's plenty more that others will reflect on as well. Thank you again, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
It's been so much fun to be with you, Janelle. Thanks for having me.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.